Hey everyone, welcome to the prediction show of the Goody Reader Radio Show. A lot of guests on the show today, and first, as I'm joined every Monday by Digital Book World's own Jeremy Greenfield. Jeremy, happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you, Michael.
So, predictions. I know you yourself and myself have really gone to town making our prediction list for 2014. So I want you to regale me with tales of what you think will transpire in the publishing world, the ebook world, and everything else going forward in 2014.
Well, Michael, thank you for asking, first of all. But what we do at Digital Book World is a little different than what a lot of other places do predictions-wise. We don't make the predictions. We talk to about a dozen experts or so who give us a long list of predictions. And then what we do is we take those predictions and we take their thoughts and we sort of choose the 10 best and then go with that. And then in the coming weeks, we'll show everybody all the predictions that hit the cutting room floor. And maybe we'll get criticized for which ones we chose. I mean, every year we come out with this, we do this article, 10 Bold Predictions for Ebooks and Digital Publishing in 2014. Somebody gets upset that we said the predictions were bold, or maybe they're too old, or the timing's wrong. But generally, a lot of people read it, and a lot of people like it. And you know the answer. You know the point of these things, Michael, isn't, you know, to be 100% right. It's about provoking some thoughts and some ideas and getting people talking about what's happening. And I think we've done that. So with that said, I will give you Digital Book World's 10 bold predictions for ebooks and digital publishing in 2014. They're not my predictions. They're predictions from a whole crowd of experts in the industry. You ready?
Yep, I'm ready. Let's do it.
All right. Feel free to interrupt with questions, comments, etc.
Yeah, of course.
So the first one I think is extremely bold. Barnes & Noble will close or sell Nook and go private. And a lot of people might say, well, that's not so bold. Barnes & Noble's been on the ropes for a little while, and the company's lost money on Nook for a while. But when a multi-billion dollar company shuts down a multi-million dollar operation that is one-third of its company in terms of, you know, its focus, that is a big deal. And to predict that at all is bold. And let's also not forget, timing is really important with these. I mean, we all know that in 1,000 years, Nook probably won't exist. But what about in 5 years? What about in 3 years? So we're saying this year is the year that that will happen.
I'm in agreement with you halfway. I think that probably Barnes & Noble will abandon e-readers for sure. I don't know if they'll abandon tablets because they have, I think, two tablets that went to the FCC about 3 weeks ago. And the company is really touting their digital magazine ecosystem, a lot of full-color content. I don't think that the way that Barnes & Noble is moving in their digital direction, I don't think that it's indicative to e-readers. You know, a lot of their content is not geared towards black and white. It's geared towards full color. And I think that probably Barnes & Noble will release two tablets in 2014. And it's in their vested interest to sell their digital content because really that's where they make the most money. You know, companies don't make money with hardware. They make money with, you know, license agreements with like third parties or selling content. And I think that Barnes & Noble has a lot of content. They just are looking for avenues to sell it, whether it's through the Microsoft deals where now they have all of their books on Windows 8 in like a ton of different countries and, you know, selling in the UK and the US and perhaps expansion now into Germany and Spain and a few other key markets. Who knows? But I don't know if I agree with Barnes & Noble's getting out of the hardware game altogether.
That might be true, but you know, Nook can continue. If this prediction is to come true, Nook can continue to exist. It just won't be owned by Barnes & Noble. So one of the ways this prediction can come true is if Barnes & Noble sells the Nook business. And I think that it's possible that that would happen. Also, I feel like we're going to start to see the fruits of Barnes & Noble's revamped strategy in the next 2 to 3 quarters. And if by the end of the year the company's still hemorrhaging money, I would not be surprised if you see some drastic action on the company's part. So I think all your points are completely valid, but it's a long year ahead of us, and a lot can happen, so we'll see.
All right, moving on.
So the next prediction. Amazon will open its own physical stores in 2014. And we're not just talking a mall kiosk like in San Francisco, or lockers like, you know, that Amazon had in Radio Shack and Staples and a few others. Talking about a dedicated Amazon store with, you know, more or less permanent bricks and mortar locations where Amazon can show off its new devices and, you know, its books from Amazon Publishing, and maybe a rotating group of its best-selling items from its website. And, you know, the Bezos and company have long said that they are interested in a physical retail location if it makes sense from a return on investment perspective. And I think, you know, this is the year with Amazon being more of a technology and device hardware company than ever, with Amazon possibly releasing its own phone, possibly releasing its own set-top box, releasing more original content, that Amazon is going to want to have a physical presence.
Yeah, I mean, I think it all depends on where they're paying it, like tax, because one of the things actually I learned from reading that book, Amazon and Everything Store, was the reason why they chose Seattle is because Seattle or Washington State traditionally does not have a lot of people buying things online, and so they pay the least amount of tax being in Washington or being in Seattle than anywhere else. And so I don't think that the I think the likelihood of them opening up a retail store in Washington State, which is their home state, I think that's probably the least likelihood, because if they start doing that, then it could open up the floodgates of just charging for tax for everything because they
Well,
actually
Amazon
have a
is
retail
now,
location.
yeah, but Amazon is now collecting sales tax in many, many states. Amazon basically has stopped fighting that battle. And what the company has done, and this is, you know, all from the Everything Store, and actually we spoke to Brad Stone for this article, and he's the author of the Everything Store, and he was the one who actually, one of the people who suggested this prediction.
Oh.
But Amazon has made a series of deals state by state where to delay the collecting of sales tax, it promised to build certain infrastructure in the state. So in the next few years, Amazon will be collecting sales tax from probably every U.S. state. But yeah, you're right. The plant costs, including collection of sales tax, are a huge consideration for this move.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be a good move. I mean, I think that when they did the kiosk stores in California, that I think it was about 2 weeks ago now. I mean, every single major news publication talked about it. They're like, "Is this like indicative of like a bigger plan for them?" And I'm like, "No, they're just trying to like, you know, put Kindles and e-readers in front of people because hardly any retail chains actually sell the e-readers anymore because they didn't want to become showroom floors for Amazon." Their words, not mine. All right, let's move on.
Great. So the third prediction. Trade publishers will sell and acquire assets to verticalize their businesses. Now, this is a very bold prediction. I think out of the top three, this is the one I think is the least likely to come true. I think that, so what this prediction is basically about is saying that companies like Hachette or Penguin Random House or Macmillan are going to sell some of their trade publishing assets. Maybe they'll sell their science fiction list and they'll buy a romance list, with the intention of beefing up in one and ramping down in another. Because what publishers are going to realize, according to this prediction, is that one of the big edges that they can have when they're going out to authors and agents and saying, "Hey, we want to publish your book," is a very strong arm, marketing arm for books that are in that category. So the stronger they are in, say, romance, with a couple of vertical communities and big Twitter feeds and just big Facebook presences, the easier it'll be for them to acquire authors and to be effective at marketing, and they're going to verticalize in those directions. So this prediction involves a lot of financial activity, and financial activity is always really hard to predict.
Yeah, totally. I mean, do you think that any of this relies on any big breakout titles coming out to like sort of stimulate that trend?
You know, it's really, really hard to say. So I guess what you're surmising or theorizing is that there's a big breakout title from, you know, HarperCollins that, or not HarperCollins, I'm sorry, Simon and Schuster, which I believe has a XOXO after dark new adult sort of erotica romance
Yeah.
community. And so there's a breakout title, and publishers then see that XOXO after dark, was a huge part in making it big, and then it gets a lot of momentum and starts to sort of verticalize on its own. I think that's one way it could happen. I mean, another way it can happen is the strategy folks and each of the publishers sort of figure out that that's what they want to do and go in that direction. I mean, companies like FNW Media, my own employer, has been doing this for years, you know, building out these vertical communities, strengthening the big ones, you know, pairing off things that aren't working as well. So, for instance, our design community went through huge evolutions over the past 5 years, where one magazine, ID, which wasn't making money, was sort of shut down and evolved into a, you know, the print and how web presences and things in that area were really heavily invested in. So it could be many, many factors that lead to this, or it could be, you know, publishers keep on operating as they do.
I don't know if that will occur, because we've seen a lot of things happen in 2013, a lot of acquisitions, a lot of mergers, a lot of new platforms being launched, you know, a lot of, I think every major publisher has like their equivalent, you know, of these social communities that are geared towards, you know, crowdsourced activities, you know, sort of like Wattpad emulators and things like that, trying to get the crowd to determine what the next big title would be, whether it's a title coming from within the crowd or whether that author is leveraging that crowd to get behind their book in order to make it the next breakout title.
Absolutely.
All right, let's move on to the next one.
All right. So this is a tough one. This is a really tough one, because I love illustrated books. I love enhanced ebooks and those innovative products. But the illustrated book business will become severely challenged. You know, it was hard for me to put this one in, but so many people were talking about it that I really had to bow to that and get it in there. Basically, the places that have traditionally sold many illustrated books, like a Barnes & Noble and independent bookstores, and the way that these places are not seeing as much foot traffic anymore as they were before. Fewer books are being sold there. They're devoting less shelf life to books. So the way that many illustrated books used to be sold is you walked into the Barnes & Noble for that bestseller, and you left with a couple other extra things, a couple cookbooks and things like that, because they jumped off the shelf to you. They had really attractive covers, or maybe you gave them as gifts. So the foot traffic in those stores for bestsellers is really getting cut into because of ebooks and Amazon. Second of all, the transition to digital for these books has not been a smooth one the way it has for immersive reading. So a lot of those print dollars that are going away aren't being replaced by digital dollars. And then there's another sort of current that's really hurting the digital side, the illustrated digital side, which is that a lot of the information that we used to get from illustrated titles, like, you know, how do I do this pot roast, and, you know, how am I going to fix my garden? You get that information for free on YouTube these days, or in many other free locations. So the illustrated book business has been challenged for a while, but 2014 may just be the year that we see some visible stressors, maybe acquisitions, or companies will go bankrupt, or companies will announce that they're doing less in the area. At the same time, there's some good news. So, you know, companies may realize that they can't afford to do all the fancy bells and whistles that they wanted to with some of the illustrated books, and will start commoditizing the way they produce them, and the costs will therefore come down to produce some of these, and maybe make P&Ls for publishers that make a little bit more sense.
I think I totally agree with you in that prediction. Look what happened with Formers travel guides.
Yeah.
Sold to Google. Google didn't do anything with it. The original group behind Formers tried to buy their assets back, and everything's basically in limbo, you know, for like the last 3 years, with nothing really being produced, things being paid, but nothing really officially released. And it goes to show you, you know, that, you know, for travel guides, you know, if you're not Lonely Planet, you're not doing well, because you look at television, there's so many travel shows now. You only have to, you know, Google where you want to go in the internet and, you know, check out community forums of that place. You know, there's a lot of resources out there that don't necessitate spending $40 or $50 on travel guides anymore.
Absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely.
Let's move on to the next one.
Next prediction. Publishers will go after new revenue streams as ebook revenue growth continues to taper. So this one, I almost want to add to it a little bit. You know, ebook revenue growth may be tapering for some publishers, for others it's not. But I think across the country, and there's really no way we can measure this, it's actually growing significantly overall because of the sort of unmeasured indie authors. And this is something we've talked about a lot. I think people pointed out in the comments that we sort of forgot to mention that, but it was something I was definitely thinking in mind while compiling this. But, you know, we know that the AAP reports that ebook growth is pretty much flattened for most of the year. But what about those indie publishers and those indie authors? And I feel like we've seen a lot of growth in that area this year. It's not anything that we have really good measurements on. But as some of these publishers see that ebooks for them are sort of tapering off with that 20 to 40% area of revenue, because it varies widely by publishers, they're going to start thinking, you know, how else can we generate new and more revenue, especially as print continues to be challenged. And I think they're going to start to figure that out. They're going to launch conferences. They're going to launch media plays in terms of, like, what F&W does with vertical media sites. So we've got magazines and e-commerce stores. And they're going to find other ways to generate money. For instance, one of the things F&W does is through its e-commerce stores, it doesn't just sell books and e-books. It also sells, you know, third-party products and other information products that people can buy. So I think a lot of publishers are going to get clued into that this year. And especially if they build a direct-to-consumer infrastructure, they're going to start to realize that that's a lot more valuable than just marketing books, or that has a lot more value in it than just using it to market books, I mean.
You know, I think I agree in some respects that ebook sales are flattening out. We're not seeing the explosive growth in that sector that we did in 2010, 2011, and even 2012. We were seeing dramatic increases across the board. If everyone, you know, recording between 5 and 6%, or sometimes 12% growth, you know, year on year. And in 2013, we haven't really saw that. We saw a little bit of growth, but not dramatic growth. It's been like modest growth, sales increasing anywhere between 1 and 3% for like the major publishers. And for the smaller publishers, I mean, it's always hard to track that data because, you know, they're private companies for a lot of the parts, and they don't really divulge a lot of their figures publicly, unless you're in the UK and you're mandated to do so. So it's really hard to sort of know what's actually going on in the small publisher landscape unless you're talking to them, you know, at conferences such as Digital Book World and other places like that. You know, HarperCollins is now selling ebooks directly through readers on their own website, and, you know, they're trying to phase out, you know, the third-party retailers. Whether this is a trend or not remains to be seen. But one of the big things that are sort of going to be following that is what Marvel's doing. Marvel has relied on Comixology as a digital crutch, you know, for the last 3 or 4 years, you know, on Android and iOS, on Windows 8, and a myriad of other platforms. And, you know, if Marvel wanted to sell books, they had to do it through Comixology. And Marvel is going to try to do that themselves now that they have sort of that digital following. They want to start selling their comics themselves and phasing out the middlemen. So I don't know if this bodes well for Comixology and losing one of the major publishers, if not the most major publisher in the world. But yes, you know, the industry is in a state of flux, and we're definitely going to see a lot more, you know, not in just mergers and acquisitions, but we're going to see the landscape start to consolidate.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think that, you know, HarperCollins, for instance, is trying to cut Amazon out. I just think the publishers are trying to diversify, you know, where they get their money. You know, nobody likes relying on just one customer, because if that customer gets fickle or something significant changes, then you're in big trouble.
Yeah.
So, moving on. More publishers will endorse the subscription ebook model by doing business with Oyster, Scribd, and other similar services like, say, Intitle or Knockbox is another one that I've heard about that's possibly coming out soon. You know, it seems like maybe the hard work that the biz dev folks at Oysters and Scribd did signing some of those early publishers, and Tidal also, you know, has Simon & Schuster, whereas the other two services don't have any business with Simon & Schuster yet, may start an avalanche. I think most of the publishers who haven't signed, especially the large ones, are going to sit on the sideline, see how it works, see if these services take off or if they die. And if they start to take off, they're going to start to do deals with them. I mean, I don't think that, you know, a large and even a medium-sized publisher doesn't risk much by sitting on the sidelines and waiting to see if it's worth the time and money and possible investment there. But I think that we will see some of those publishers come off the sidelines this year, and at least one more Big Five publisher is going to sign with these guys, if not more than one.
You know, it's too early to really tell on how those trends are doing. Since Scribdwiz picked up, we haven't really seen anything in a relation to, you know, our user base has increased by X amount, the site has made X amount of dollars. Same with Oyster. I don't think that they've really divulged their total user base, how many book sales that they've done from launch to from their beta users. And, you know, even, what was that new one? Entitle. you know, it's too early to tell. Everything's just launched or is in the process of launching. I don't think that ebook subscription sites are going to go anywhere. They're populated by backlist titles. And I don't think, you know, if you're, say, a Lee Child fan, you've probably read most of the older books and you're waiting for the new books to be released. And if you subscribe to any of these services thinking that you're going to get the new title that's coming out in 2 weeks, you're sadly mistaken. Those sites only really get the older books, and that's part of the agreement. They don't want, you know, the major publishers, you know, even with Overdrive, in a lot of cases, they're not giving them front list titles. They're giving them backlist titles to see if there's any traction with there. And with your hardcore readers that are actually going to be subscribing to these services, I think it's a deal breaker that if they're not getting the new books and they're just getting the old books that they probably have read already.
So I think for my own usage that I agree with you. It doesn't make sense for me. But I think it will make sense for some people. I think some people will give it as gifts. And, you know, like Netflix or Spotify, you know, there are a lot of people that are subscribed to these services that used them, that don't anymore. Maybe they'll use them again or don't use them to the fullest potential or forget to use them for whatever reason because they get in a groove using some other service or they're on vacation or whatever. I think a lot of people will try this, if I had to guess. I think the odds are against it really taking off. But I think people will try it. I think these services have been very clever with biz dev and marketing. And also, you know, I do think there's a chance that some of these services will develop a way to get some front list titles. You know, Netflix has had some success luring original content, for instance, to draw people, alluring, you know, the latest movies and TV series. They get select titles here and there.
House of Cards.
Sure, House of Cards is a great example, or, you know, I think the latest Iron Man movie or something like that's on Netflix right now, and they get relatively new releases, and they can't get all the new releases, but they can get some of them, and so, you know, they might develop a brand where the people who are on Oyster know, like, okay, so there's 100,000 or 200,000 or whatever books. I always have a book to read if I want to, but occasionally that new bestseller will be on the platform, and maybe publishers will use it as a marketing arm. Maybe they'll do special deals with Oyster subscribers. I mean, anything could happen. I personally don't think it makes financial sense for me to sign up to Oyster, but I'm not going to count them out yet.
You know, I agree. The services aren't for me because, you know, I'm there at the physical bookstore when new titles are released almost every Tuesday. You know, I'm there in the store buying books, you know, and I'm still one of the, you know, as much as I write about digital, you know, I know
this is your dirty secret.
Yeah, I hardly buy ebooks at all. I mean, I'll buy like schlock, you know, fantasy, sci-fi, and things like that. But, you know, for the good fantasy and sci-fi, like books by Neil Gaiman, you know, I'm buying those books from the physical bookstore because I'm lending them out to friends. You know, a lot of my friends have the same taste in books as I do, so I loan a lot of the books I buy out with ebooks. Hardly any of my friends have e-readers, or if they do, they have Kindles, which aren't compatible with EPUB, blah, 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 right? But I think that the only way that these ebook subscription platforms can grow is if they market it. Because right now, they've pretty well relied on headlines from websites like ours, you know, in order to build some brand identity. But they have to start advertising, television commercials, YouTube commercials, branding out across the web. And that's something that they haven't done yet. And until they do that, they're not really going to get any mainstream traction because there's a lot of ebook subscription sites out there. What distinguishes one from the other? Nobody really knows.
Yeah, well, we shall see.
All right.
So, moving on. This dovetails with an earlier prediction about publishers finding new revenue streams and also publishers verticalizing. More publishers will launch magazines and websites catering to reader interests and start selling ebooks directly to customers. So it's a little bit different because this is another piece of the puzzle, that publishers will take these vertical communities and launch, you know, media plays around them. And sort of the holy grail of that is, say, a magazine that's all about romance, and you end up actually getting people to pay to subscribe to it and advertisers to pay to be involved in it. So the marketing itself ends up generating income. So that's kind of the holy grail of that. But also the other side of it is that publishers will also sell directly to consumers. And we're already seeing some publishers doing it, but I think we'll see an avalanche of publishers doing it this year. As the complexity of that goes down, as publishers become less afraid of competing with their customers, they will find ways to offer direct sales.
I think I agree. Let's move on.
All right. Publishers will move toward data-driven decision-making. I mean, we've been talking about data and publishing for a long time, and I started covering this industry about, you know, a little over 2 years ago, and I was shocked with the level of digital sophistication in every other area of the media industry, how little publishers and editors and marketers are using data to make day-to-day decisions. You know, as an editor myself, I use data all the time to make day-to-day decisions.
Same, yeah.
And I think, you know, but our side of the media industry, periodical media, magazine media, that sort of stuff, we've been using data since, you know, 2005, 6, 7. I'm sure it's been used a lot more than that, but my familiarity with using digital data is around then. So I think we're going to see this a lot more. A lot of the big publishers have started hiring people not only to crunch data. In the past few years, they really built up those departments, but now to help digest that data and sort of bring it to the rest of the company and use it. So I think that there are some vanguard publishers, like, say, for instance, Sourcebooks. Random House is a very highly developed data department. They're doing it, but all the publishers are going to follow. And I think this is an area where small publishers and even some medium-sized publishers are going to be left behind, and where scale is really going to hurt them. I mean, it's hard to have, I don't know, a half a dozen to a dozen people working in a data department if you've only got 30 employees to begin with. So maybe there's a third-party opportunities there to use data to help publishers make decisions, but I think this is something that's really going to take off this year.
I totally agree. There's... You know, we travel along the similar circuits, you know, in terms of like the big conventions and trade shows, the big publishing events. And one company that I've always really respected because of their big data mentality was Know, who were heavily involved in digital textbook sales, but they had like a fleet of apps that were geared towards students. And one of their executives, I think his name was Babur, he was notorious for almost being at every event and sitting on these like really high level big data panels where he was, you know, outlining the importance of big data analytics, being able to tweak and tailor their product based on their user data. And I thought that that was so essential to their growth, that they were like, this was almost their number one priority. They didn't really make a change or add new content to the platform unless big data told them to do so. And I think with ebooks and content like that, there really isn't a lot of big data that people are using. You know, you look at your average ebook and they don't have analytics code inside of it. So you don't know how long it takes for someone to read a book. If the people are finishing the book, how long does it take for them to, you know, to get through it? And, you know, has that book ever been read before, or did someone just buy it and never read it? Those are questions that, you know, a lot of people are asking, but there's no data out there because there isn't really advanced big data code for these books, whether they're ebooks, whether they're magazines offer a little bit more, but like certainly textbooks and a lot of markets like that. There's a severe absence. So I agree that there's a lot of opportunities out there for, you know, startups to focus on that and offer big data services to small and medium press publishers.
And I think they will.
All right.
So prediction number 9, more price experimentation. So we've tracked the price of best-selling ebooks very, very closely over this past year and a half, and they have plummeted. I think this year we're going to see that retailers and publishers are going to experiment even more with price. And this goes everything from the price that publishers sell retailers their books, the price that publishers themselves sell their books at, the way they bundle them and do specials to sort of not be in direct competition with their customers, the way retailers price books, the way that publishers price books to libraries, I think is going to be experimented with this year. Now that there's a year or more of the wholesale model being used across the entire industry, there's a lot more data about how it works and how it doesn't work, and I think there'll be a lot more experimentation now over the next year. And I think we're going to see some dramatic things happen, a lot of price competition, a lot of parries and moves back and forth, and it's been an exciting year when it comes to pricing.
Do you think the company to like the major publishers, because it always comes down to what are the major publishers doing, because a lot of the times they'll do something and everyone else will follow them. Do you think that the whole Penguin deal, do you think that they will be the first person or the first organization to really experiment with price drops just because they control basically more than a quarter of all published books now?
All of the publishers are already aggressively experimenting. So I think that first publisher to experiment is maybe a little bit it's a little too late for that, but I think we're going to see it in a much more aggressive way this year. And I wouldn't be surprised if Penguin Random House, made that play. Now, if it were me, and I'm totally an outsider looking in, I don't have any direct knowledge of this. I think I would look at my market position if I'm Penguin Random House and be aggressive. I think at some point, the way the industry is changing becomes an existential issue for publishers, and that, a cornered animal is a dangerous animal. And I think that I would be very, very aggressive at trying to figure out angles to build advantages in the industry. I wouldn't be looking quarter to quarter and year to year in terms of profits and revenues. I would think about the long term. So I think you're quite right. It could be Penguin Random House that we see make some aggressive moves in this area.
But in the end, for the average consumer, say, listening to this show, does that mean lower ebook prices? People's dollars will be able to go further.
I think that, I mean, I've been predicting this for a while, but I think that we've seen them go just about as low as they're going to get. I don't think they're going to go any lower on a permanent basis. I think in 2014, what you expect to pay for a best-selling ebook is between $5 and $7.
I think I agree. So, number 10, the final prediction of 2014.
This one's a little tepid by comparison to some of the others, but I think that, just because it seems like it might happen doesn't mean it necessarily will. You think that something's going to happen in the future, maybe you look at the stock market or in sports, this team will definitely beat that team. It doesn't always happen. So I think this is a bold prediction as well, that all of the big five publishers will make their full catalogs available to libraries to purchase as e-books in the next year. So right now we've got Macmillan doesn't sell frontlist e-books to libraries, and Simon & Schuster is only in a pilot phase with its library program. I think those two are going to open up in 2014, and their entire catalogs, along with Penguin Random House, HarperCollins, and YM Hachette, are going to all sell all of their e-books, make them available to sale to libraries.
People have been asking for that for a long time. And, I think Overdrive is probably the largest company when it comes to, digital consumption. I think I just got a media thing from Overdrive today that Overdrive has got 1 million digital checkouts in 2013. And I think that this is definitely up from anything that they've done in the past. And
Yeah, no, actually, we wrote about this. And I talked to the people at Overdrive. Last year, in 2012, two libraries went over 1 million ebook checkouts. This year, six libraries went over 1 million ebook checkouts with huge gains from last year. So checking out ebooks from libraries is really taking off. Now, does that make the publishers happy? Does that make them upset? Is that going to make them pull back or move forward? Well, the folks who follow this thing, the folks I talk to, think it's going to make them push forward with it.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, there's Baker and Taylor with their Axis 360. There's 3M with their 3M Cloud Library. So it'll be good news for those guys to help their marketing efforts for them to branch out and hopefully not usurp Overdrive's market position because they can't. It's impossible. But it's certainly that they're. I think consumers will benefit because there's more frontlist titles. There's more titles in the pool to begin with from their local library. And I would really like to see a lot of the restrictions being lifted in terms of, you know, it's one thing to contribute more frontlist titles, but then there's a lot of, every major publisher almost has their own requirements for library lending, whether it's 25 total checkouts before the customer or before the library has to buy a new title, or one title, one use. You know, it will go to, you know, that will that ebook be able to be lent out, you know, simultaneously to two different users? There's a lot of difficulty in the library sphere because every publisher has different requirements. And I would like to see more of a universal standard develop. Whether that occurs in 2014 or not remains to be seen. I don't think it will. I think it'll still take a few more years of data. But I think that in 2013, a lot of publishers signed up to do business with libraries that have been either resistive all along, or whether they did pilot projects in the past, pulled everything, reevaluated it, and then slowly, you know, tepidly got back into it. I think I would agree in the respects that 2014 is going to be a big year for libraries and for the companies that facilitate the loaning and lending of digital content, such as Overdrive.
Well, I think maybe you're right on asking for all those other things. Might be a little bit too bold even for us, but perhaps someday.
All right. So we've been talking to Jeremy Greenfield of A Digital Book World, and the Digital Book World Conference is coming up beginning of January. Why don't you plug that?
Well, I would love to. So it's the biggest eBooks and digital publishing conference in the world. Everyone is going to be there, from publishers to agents to authors to editors to anyone, and technologists, anyone you can imagine in digital publishing. We've got a whole bunch of satellite conferences. We've got LeVar Burton hosting the Digital Book Awards. We've got Jim Cramer from Mad Money talking about investing in the content industries. Brad Stone talking about his book, The Everything Store, and Amazon in general. And having spent some time on the phone with him over these past 2 weeks, he is super duper sharp, and I think he's going to be fantastic, maybe one of the best things that we've got at this new conference. And, you know, I'll be there, and you'll be there, Michael.
Yeah, reason
So
enough for everyone to come.
that should be reason enough for everyone to come. You know, we've got workshops, we've got the gala for the awards, we've got a whole conference on higher education publishing. We've got a whole conference on children's publishing, a whole conference on digital production and design. So there's really something for everyone, something at all price points. And honestly, who doesn't want to take a trip to New York?
I know I do.
Exactly.
All right, guys. So we've heard Jeremy's bold predictions of 2014. And next, we'll be talking to staff writer of Goody Reader, Mercy Pilkington, on independent and self-publishing predictions of 2014. So stay tuned. We're back here on the show, and we're joined by Goody Reader staff writer Mercy Pilkington. Mercy, how's it going?
It's going great. How are you?
Not too bad. So we just got off the horn with Jeremy Greenfield of Digital Book World, and he regaled us with tales of their top 10 predictions of 2014. So in continuing the trend, I know that you're specialized in self-publishing and digital publishing news in general. So you're the dominant force when it comes to a speculative analysis on the current state of the industry, as well as being able to forecast where it'll go. It's less about predictions and more or less, you know, looking at the trends, you know, what's happened this year versus what's going to happen next year based on trends. So let's talk a little bit about how you feel the landscape will change, you know, going forward. So what's your first prediction?
My first one is very exciting, and it's actually about the fact that subscription reading seems to finally have found its niche. when we first started covering subscription-based reading with different models, it started, 2010, I believe, when we interviewed 24 Symbols out of Spain. And at the time, lots of companies jumped up with these models, some of them based on freemium, some of them trying to be a Netflix-style model. What we found at the time is a lot of those just kind of faded away or took a long time to get their feet under them. And the reason for that was the ever-present need to compensate the publishers and the authors. And at the time, back in 2010, a lot of publishers still weren't even talking about ebooks yet. And so they were certainly not jumping on board with letting people pay an all-you-can-eat price to read their content and to read their authors' works. And so now, first of all, now that we've got the whole landscape of digital publishing kind of secured in people's minds and in publishers' minds, now I think the industry is ready to look at subscription reading. And so even the ones that originally took off, they had a lot of trouble getting some really great content. They were quick to get a few big name publishers on board who were willing to put their backlist titles or maybe even midlist. But now we're finding companies like eReader, Oyster, and Scribd are having a much easier time inking these deals with publishers. I know this week Perseus just signed with Oyster, for example, joining HarperCollins, Houghton Mifflin, several others. And of course, at the top of all that, Smashwords has made its catalog available for subscription to Scribd and to Oyster. And so I think that's going to be one thing that really takes off. It feels like we know what we're doing, we know what we need to do, and we know how to compensate authors and the publishers, excuse me. And so that's going to, I hope that blows up this year, that more and more people, you know, everywhere you go, there's Netflix and there's Spotify for music. Hopefully there'll be Oyster and Scribd on everyone's devices and everyone can be a subscriber to books.
Yeah, I mean, Jeremy and I actually talked a little bit about this, but I kind of want to elaborate with it with you. It seemed like in 2010, 2011, it was too early to do like the Netflix or the quintessential Spotify for ebooks. Just the way the landscape was, I mean, during that time, it was in the state of flux. And we kind of talked about it before the show about how it's changing. And with self-published titles, I mean, I can't really think of another company besides Smashwords that is really investing themselves into the subscription-based model for the content. So if you're enamored with self-published titles, or if there's this, if you want to discover more titles instead of having to purchase, one for 99 cents or maybe one for a dollar or maybe like $5 or $10, you could read as many as you want just paying that $9.99 a month, which sort of helps with ebook discovery. And it benefits Smashwords as well, because all their authors are getting the ability to like opt into these platforms. Mm-hmm. Do you know much about the Smashwords deal? And like, if you're a Smashwords author, do you opt into those platforms, or are you automatically enrolled into, say, Oyster or Scribd by just self-publishing with Smashwords?
Yeah, that's interesting. Mark Coker actually just posted on this week on their blog. So the complete details of the Scribd agreement came out in his blog post end of last week. And I know one of the really crucial things for this was Scribd kind of did a you scratch our back, we'll scratch yours arrangement. So where the authors are opting in to have their books included in this subscription to where people can read it and benefit from it and benefit with the all crucial book discovery, those authors are automatically enrolled in Scribd as well. So they can use the service. They can benefit from marketing, promotion, and things like that just by being a Smashwords author. And on that note, for 2014, I really hope there is, my prediction, I really hope there is a Lifetime Achievement Award for furthering the publishing industry, not just the self-publishing industry, but publishing all around. And that goes really, in my book, to Smashwords. They have worked harder than probably any single platform to further books, not just authors, not just publishing models, but actually to further books. And to put those in people's hands, even if it takes, taking authors' content and putting it in a lending library or through Overdrive, through Scribd, through Oyster, whoever, whatever the model is, their goal is to put books in front of people and to help authors while they're doing it. So hopefully that prediction will come true.
All right. Well, moving on, what is your next prediction?
Along that same line, ebook lending. I see ebook lending really taking root. That I think it fell victim to the same exact problem that subscription reading did, in that it was just too soon for publishers to agree to this. Because once again, how do we pay our authors? How do we make money when people can just go to their libraries and borrow this? We saw a lot of early obstacles. For example, publishers charging libraries 300% the price of a book. So if a library was to order a print edition of a book, the ebook edition for lending was 300% higher. And that was just outside the realm of library budgets. Some of that actually felt intentional, almost as though they could say, we tried to let you borrow the ebook, you didn't want to buy it. But it really doesn't boil down to that. It really comes down to how do we get compensated? We are a business, we have to stay open, and we have to get money in order to do that. At the same time, we also saw libraries that were imposing limits. The one about the 26 checkouts, for example, where they based it on a print book. So a typical print book on average is checked out 26 times before it is no longer in good condition and another copy has to be ordered. So artificial limits were put on things that were not print books. And I think finally we're coming around to the point that they're understanding this is a good thing. And programs like the big library read between Overdrive and Sourcebooks this year, earlier in 2013, I think those very clearly defined the scope of the benefits for publishers. They took a book, Michael Malone's Four Corners of the Sky, if I remember correctly, and they demonstrated that not only did his social media following go up, sales of that book increased, and sales of his other unrelated books increased once the book was made available for lending. It was made available to all of Overdrive's partner libraries for free simultaneously with no barriers. So basically, no wait list, no checkout limits, no nothing. And
That was a great
everything,
program.
it really was. And that was the whole point. It was, I guess, I think maybe we shouldn't say program. It was an experiment. And the whole purpose of it, when we sat down, Goody Reader sat down with Overdrive and Sourcebook CEOs at Book Expo this year and asked, why? What did you do this for? And they said, we kept hearing from publishers, we need proof. We need to know the data. Well, here it is. The data is the author's personal social media traffic increased and sales of all of his books, not just this one, increased once people were able to borrow it and read it. So a lot of those sales probably came from people who didn't have time to finish it but wanted to, but also people who became devoted readers of his, as evidenced by people ordering and buying copies of his other books. And so I know Overdrive repeated this with a children's title later on and did the same thing, just to show that when you let people borrow a book, they become followers of the author and of the publisher as well. And so I think ebook lending in 2014 is finally going to be one of those household things. I mean, we still have small town public libraries with very small budgets who cannot get a lot of great content to their patrons without waiting for the one time of year when they have their fiscal budget. I think we're also going to see a lot more people who are now connected and see the relevance of libraries, which is always vital. A very recent study that we reported on showed that from the Pew Internet Group said that Americans need libraries. They claim that libraries are vital to their communities, but only slightly more than half the people reported that they actually went to their library that year. Where 90% of them were saying, yes, we need libraries, slightly more than half were actually using libraries. If those people had a mechanism to use the library from their phone, from their devices, without having to drive across town, I think we're going to see that relevance even increase and more funding and support for libraries. And ebooks are the way to do that.
I totally agree. So, what's your third prediction?
Okay, moving on. I think self-publishing is going to have a great year coming up. It's almost like the whole industry around ebooks, whether it's traditional or self-published, I think it's always pushing the envelope and saying, what can we do now? And so I think coming up this year, we're going to see great things for self-published authors. Personally, what I would love to see happen, whether it's a prediction or just a pipe dream, I would love to see Barnes & Noble finally get its foothold by making it possible for independent authors to put their books in physical bookstores. That is just an untapped resource. Everybody talks about bringing down the mighty Amazon. Amazon can't do that well. This year, they actually made their expanded distribution through CreateSpace free. It used to be $25 for an author's title to be included in the Ingram catalog, made available to libraries, bookstores, things like that. There was still no guarantee that any physical outlet would order the book. it was just possible to order the book. And this year, Amazon took that $25 fee away. It's free. Every book can be included and can be ordered if you have the connections and the means to get a library or bookstore to choose to order your book and stock it on their shelves. I think Barnes & Noble is missing a boat. They can quite easily, they have the stores. Make it possible. You know, rope off a section if you have to, and make this the indie book section. Rotate the books out. Come up with an agreement where the author buys back his copies of his book. The really interesting, fun thing is that the books will still come from Amazon because CreateSpace is owned by Amazon. So most self-published authors are finding it easier to use CreateSpace than some of the other companies out there. So Amazon will still benefit if Barnes & Noble stocks print copies in their bookstores. But that is the one thing authors still do not have their hands on. And I hope 2014 is the year we get that. Also, I think we're seeing kind of the gold miner trend of self-publishing, I hope, is kind of fizzling out. And I think 2014, we're going to see a return to dedication of writing craft as not just something that authors are dedicated to, but that they're also career-minded to. I think the early floodgates opening of people just deciding to slap a book up on Kindle and get rich quick, I think that's gone away. I think, you know, we've flooded the market with these books. We're swimming in a sea of crap in many cases. And I think 2014 is where we're going to see people going, you know, this is not quite the moneymaker I thought it was. And we're going to see a return to great quality writing in our self-published books.
Yeah, I mean, that I think is critical. And I've seen for myself, like many companies start, you know, a year or two ago and just fade away. And a lot of authors I've been talking to, the same thing, where it's like, you know, ebooks permeated every aspect of the media culture, you know, interviews on television, exposés on big websites like the Guardian or the Ireland Times and things like that. And it seems like it's getting more consolidated, you know, and the publishing industry in general is getting more consolidated. You look at the Penguin merger, and that tells you that even on the grand scale that, you know, people are banding together to get, you know, to have everything under one roof for promotion, for to have more leverage in determining ebook prices and to deal with these big retail chains. But I kind of want to get back to what you said about Barnes & Noble and Nook Press. I think that that's critical. And, you know, the Barnes & Noble retail stores are doing modestly well, whereas like Nook Media, it seems like every quarter they're just losing more and more money. And I think that that would be good synergy for them to be able to like leverage their digital ecosystem with their tangible stores. So not only their Barnes & Noble bookstores, but also their college bookstores as well. And being able to, you know, get people to submit indie textbooks and things like that, travel guides, self-published travel guides, you know, cookbooks, you know, things like that. And, you know, Nook Press is fairly limiting. It really only gets ebooks right now. It's not really designed for, you know, EPUB 3 or what iBooks Author does, where you can embed animations and audio and multimedia type elements. And yeah, I think Barnes & Noble is missing a golden opportunity here. And I would probably say that it's probably something they haven't even considered, or if they did, it was very low-level talks within the organization and never really got anywhere. I mean, we both know a lot of people within the Barnes & Noble organization. You know, Teresa Horner, the guys in charge of like Nook Digital and things like that. We've all talked to them on many different occasions, and it seems as though that they're obsessed with the idea of hardware, of milking their Microsoft relationship and getting the Nook app on as many devices as possible, but they're not really building any synergy between Nook Media and a traditional retail chain. And I would probably say that 2014 is a little bit too optimistic to think about that, but I really think that unless they do that, there's really no way that Barnes & Noble ebook price-wise can compete with Amazon. And they've tried to do that all during 2013, and it's a money-losing proposition. You can't outprice match Amazon. And right. You know, they try to do that, and you know, every quarter they lose more and more and more money. was if they were to take their digital books and put them in a retail store, you could offer these indie titles at severely reduced prices and actually encourage people to go in these bookstores and pay $2.99 for a new title that just came out.
Right. And yeah, and that's one of the things that I know we've covered a lot in our opinion pieces on Goody Reader is, yeah, there's so much talk about what's it going to take to bring down Amazon. First of all, why are we trying to bring down Amazon? But that's for another discussion. Really, what companies like Barnes & Noble, even with their Nook Press, but also with their physical retail stores, as well as the American Booksellers Association and the independent booksellers, stop trying to compete with Amazon. Do something different. You are competing with a company that does not have brick and mortar retail stores. So why are you trying to compete with them? Offer the public something that they don't offer and be happy with what you offer instead. And right off the bat, one of the top things that Amazon cannot offer is a physical bookstore where I can walk in and pick up a print copy of an independently published book. And it's not there. And so do that instead. And hopefully 2014 will be the year somebody finally wakes up and decides to do that and really do that in a targeted way.
Yeah, I mean, looking at the digital book industry in 2013, it was all about automatic price matching. Nook, Kobo, Sony, they all have like these price matching algorithms where if Nook reduces the price on a mainstream title, Amazon will automatically match it, Barnes & Noble will automatically match it, Kobo will automatically match it. And yeah, I see that as like a losing proposition because, you know, sure, people will save money on books, but if you're a Sony user, you're just buying books from Sony. If you're a Kindle user, generally you're only buying books by Amazon. If you have a Kobo device, you're only buying books from Kobo. So I wish that these companies would put less of an emphasis on competing against one another and offering more compelling reasons to deal with that ecosystem in general.
And to come back to Smashwords, we don't need our separate stores. If the price is going to be the same everywhere and my store is only based on my brand loyalty to my device, Smashwords can easily step in and wipe them all out by offering a one-stop shop location where I can get the copy of the book I want for whatever device I've got. And it might be that I've got different devices. Maybe I want to read it on my smartphone and on this tablet, and my husband wants to read it on that device. You know, I can get the copies I need in one location. And when consumers pick up on that, I really see that being a death blow to some of these other outlets. And if they don't come along and find another way to offer something different, rather than, like you said, a price match of the same exact book. You know, once the devices come away and we're no longer brand loyal, there's no reason to have different ebook retailers.
I totally agree. And, you know, I think, yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to, like, surmise in terms of, like, the way that the industry is going because, you know, you have, like, the top bookstores out there that, you know, they're heavily invested. And it's pretty well just Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Kobo, and Sony in North America and, like, you know, Western Europe. Those are really the money markets. All other markets, you know, it's good to get into and it's good to get those extra sales. But, you know, South America, Brazil, you know, if you look at Brazil, you know, it's not a make it or break it market. If you don't do well there, you're going out of business. It's all like, right. It's all these secondary markets. But, you know, we review every single e-reader and tablet that comes out that's geared towards reading. And that's, you know, one of our strengths. And in so doing that, we kind of recognize a lot of the shortcomings where if you look at, say, a Kindle device, you know, they purchased Goodreads. You could participate in a social author-based community there. You could, you know, we all know about Goodreads, and if you don't, they're the largest social book ecosystem out there. Any author worth their salt are talking directly with their fan base on Goodreads. Everybody's rating books, adding them to the shelves. It's like a Facebook for books. And Amazon purchased them with the sole intention of integrating that service into all their hardware devices. They're the only company that's like even bothered to focus on social reading. And it's really only been, you know, late 2013 that we ever even saw that hit the hardware. I mean, we've only really seen Goodreads hit the e-readers and tablets November. And right. What have we been doing And up until then, you know, you've had these like crappy little proprietary social stuff, like Kobo's done, you know, their readers, statistics and things like that. But I mean, it's all personalized. Like, it's all just your reading habits. You can't really share that with anybody else unless you just spam people on your Facebook wall, and nobody really wants to do that, which is why Kobo abandoned it altogether. But yeah, I mean, being able to distinguish yourself in a crowd, I think, is just so critically important now with the big companies, but even people that are thinking about launching startups to compete with those guys. You look at with Texter, they're a Berlin-based company, and they have a pretty loyal following all over Europe because they open up these bookstores and have nothing but localized books in those languages. And mm-hmm. it makes it a good value proposition, but they don't really stand out in a crowd. Their name seldom comes up in our conversations because their bookstore looks worse visually, but it looks, you know, they offer the exact same thing everyone else does. You open up the app, you know, you have a little bit of ebook discovery, you purchase a book, you read the book, and that's the end of it. And I think that companies need to focus on what comes next. After you buy that book and you read that book, what's next? Do you want to talk about that book amongst like-minded people that just read the book? I know I do. You know, if I read a book and it's fresh in my mind, you know, I want to talk to people immediately. I read Ocean at the End of the Lane by Neil Gaiman, and I was the only person in my circle of friends to have read the book. As soon as I read that book, I want to talk to people about it. I read it on Apple iBooks. There's zero social integration in that platform. I read the book and it's like, who do I talk to about it? There's no options like at all, you know?
Right. Other than just reviewing it somewhere, which may or may not lead to discussion.
Exactly. And I mean, the only alternative really to talk to people about books is Goodreads. And I wish that there was more out there. But I do think that, you know, publishers are on the right track. The ebook stores may not be, but the publishers launch these savvy little communities. Simon & Schuster, Penguin, Random House, they all have like these teen imprints that they've started. And the publishers themselves actually have these like really compelling little communities. Think of it as Wattpad lights, where, you know, authors are there talking, there's interviews with the authors, there's all this like news, there's like, you know, articles on like, you know, fashion from the Hunger Games, and it just talks about, you know, the dresses and like the hairstyles and like, you know, what designers, you know, are actually making stuff like that. Where can I actually buy it? You know, it's like these little communities that are slowly growing. And I think that if anybody's doing anything innovative on a social level, it's the major publishers, because they are fostering these like cool little communities where grassroots authors are making a name for themselves. You know, you have like any community, you have the people that have that with an obscene number of posts, you know, they have like 12,000 posts where everyone else may have like 100. And so those people stand out in a community. And if those authors, you know, end up releasing books, you have that entire community that's going to be behind them actually reading the book, much like Wattpad. So now that I've ranted and raved about that, let's talk about your next prediction.
Okay. I think there's going to be some major change in the traditional publishing industry. I don't think we're done seeing the mergers. We keep waffling. Every time we see the term Big Six, somebody puts in parentheses Big Five. We know about the Penguin Random House merger. Not much has changed in-house yet, and it will. It just hasn't happened yet to where they are one unified company entirely. I don't think we're done seeing mergers there. I think we're also going to see a lot more small press joining in with some of the big five in order to kind of keep this foothold in the industry. Unfortunately, I'm afraid that some of what's going to drive that is going to be this desperate need to compete with retailers. And we just posted an article very recently about publishers' attempts to create their own branded ebook stores that were strictly going to sell their titles. The unfortunate thing about that is I don't think we're in an era yet where readers care who the publisher is. We do find that with imprints, where I know, for example, you know, Goody Reader, we review books that are sent to us by publishers and authors, and there is one imprint now of a major publisher I will not review because the quality is awful. The editing is lousy, And so basically, rather than trash these people, I just quietly put the book aside. I've sent my letter to the publisher and said, these books do not quite meet our standards for grammar, but I haven't received a response. I'm still getting the books, and I'm just not going to trash authors' efforts that way. And so I think that might be a rare exception. I could not look at an author or a title, even working in this industry, and say, oh, well, he's published by so-and-so, unless there's a compelling reason to know that. A few household name authors do stand out, and we might know their publishers off the top of our heads. But for the most part, your average reading consumer does not. And so setting up an ebook store branded as Random House or Penguin or Simon & Schuster or whomever, I don't think is really a good targeted effort. Beyond that, I'm guilty of buying a book I've been waiting for just because I want that free shipping on Amazon. So when I'm going to Amazon to purchase something else and I see that my shopping cart lacks $10 to get me free shipping, I'll add a book. And so a lot of my book purchases come not as targeted book purchases, but because I'm there anyway, or I'm clicking through, I'm buying one book and I see something else I like. And so I think the publishers in 2014 are hopefully going to stop putting so much effort on trying to be booksellers and instead solidify the relationships they've got with existing booksellers and make them beneficial to everyone. One of the entities that keeps being left out in the cold in the publishing industry, we don't hear so much about the literary agents anymore. It was back in 2010 or 2011 that we started covering news of agents who were looking into representing ebook only and digital first clients. That quickly morphed into agents who were helping their clients self-publish their books. That received a really nasty backlash right off the top. We had a few authors who took it upon themselves to leave their agencies and really have a lot of outspoken things to say about that practice. And I think there is a good gray area happening. I think it's very possible for an agent to do something underhanded. I think it's very easy for them to just be roping in clients and taking them for a ride to get some money out of them. At the same time, a genuine literary agent works like a dog for his or her clients. And so I think we're going to see a shift in their roles, especially as we keep hearing that publishers are going to go by the wayside as more and more people self-publish. We were talking before the show about the statistic that in the few years, more books sold will be self-published than traditionally published just because of the volume of books out there. And so we don't talk a lot about literary agents. And I think 2014 is going to be the year. I do not see them going away. I do see them finding a different role to play for their clients. One of the top examples is Hugh Howey, who was quite happily not represented by anyone, and he was doing quite well as a self-published author when he was approached by Krista Nelson, who basically said, answered the question he asked, what do you plan to do for me that I'm not doing for myself? And her answer was pretty much, I don't know, but let's find out. Let's see what we can do. She helped him negotiate his print deal with Simon & Schuster to where he did not lose his ebook rights. And of course, she's working on his movie option for the first book in the Silo saga. So agents do have a job. It just might change a lot in 2014.
I totally agree. I mean, it's one of those segments in publishing that you don't really hear a lot. In the day-to-day media world, you would be remiss if you read a few articles a year anywhere. And that includes like the New York Times and the Journal and publications like ours. But they play a critical role. But it's very interesting to see the young people. Do you think that we're seeing people in college or university that are, that have and being an agent or something like that in mind from day one? So it's like, I'm second year university. This is what I want to do with my life. I'm going to finish, my master's, and then that's where I'm going to go. Do you think the youth of today are considering that as a viable career option?
I think the funny answer to that is I don't think anybody in the past went to college to become a literary agent. I say that tongue in cheek because I think a lot of agents come at this finding out, through publishing internships and things like that, finding out that it's just something they're good at. One of the shifting roles we're seeing a lot more talk about on social media is authors who are hiring contract lawyers or publishing consultants to look over a contract for them. So they've been offered a contract unagented from a publisher, and they just simply pay a one-time fee to a contract attorney or a publishing consultant to help them rewrite that contract or negotiate it, and then they go on about their business. But as far as people becoming literary agents, I think there's still a very definite need for it, especially now in the world of digital. I think there's an even greater need. There are companies springing up probably hourly, let alone overnight, who are out to take self-published authors' money. And unfortunately, it's very easy to do. And so I think we're going to see a return to some sort of agenting, whether the person calls him or herself a literary agent or a publishing consultant or whatever they refer to themselves as. I think we're going to still see that need for some handholding, especially as we move forward with what's coming for digital books.
Okay, we've heard from many industry specialists on their predictions for 2014, and I'm going to give you mine. By design, I did not mean to make this as negative as it sounds, but once I really started thinking about the way the industry is going, I didn't really see any positive aspects. So, like, first of all, talk about E-Ink. They're the company responsible for around 85% of the screen tech that we see in modern e-readers. Everything from Kindle to Nook to Kobo and a lot of European brands, they all use E-Ink screens for that really crisp resolution, that really visceral reading like a book experience. The company's in trouble. They've been cumulatively losing money every single quarter. Once in a while, big orders from Amazon and Kobo and things like that do come in, but on a quarterly basis, they're losing more money than they're bringing in. They think the future is digital signage. This year, they unveiled two new technologies called Spectra and Aurora. This gives everything from a retail environment to screens in airports the way to be able to, at a very low cost and a very low power consumption rating, to change prices or to change data. Right now we see Walmart and Target and Kmart and companies like that employ, you know, the boys generally to change prices. So things will change overnight. Part of the stock boy's duty is to update prices as well as put new things on the shelves. The larger stores get, like Best Buy and Costco and Walmart, it's becoming an increasing amount of challenges to be able to change the prices on the fly. Most big stores spend about $50,000 a month on tags, paper, and other aspects of making the prices change. E-Ink basically makes screen text so it's digital, but it looks exactly like paper, and the stuff is very low cost. Ultimately, if I have a department store, I could tie all my digital signage into a computer. I want to change the prices of soap. I want to price match things automatically. No problem. All the prices in the store update live. This will allow for the old Kmart, the blue light specials, where for, you know, an hour during a day, the price is down X number of percent. So it'd be a cool way to be able to do that without investing a lot in infrastructure. I do think that E-Ink is gravitating away from e-readers. Currently, digital signage, like I said, 6%, but I think that it's going to increase to close to about 15% by the end of 2014. I think that overall tablets, as my next prediction, will decline in 2014. We've seen the stem and the tide of new tablets coming out as declining. People just simply aren't upgrading every time a new device comes out. I know a lot of people are really happy with their iPad 2s. They haven't got the iPad 3, nor the 4, nor the Air. And there really just isn't, on a year-to-year basis, tablet technology is not changing enough to warrant the upgrades. You look at people who upgrade televisions as just an example, that when an people had the old CRT boxes for a really long time, and then LCD and plasma flat screens came out. That was the next upgrade cycle. Then HDTV started to come out. Most people had their regular TVs for between 5 or 10 years. Hey, that's reason enough to upgrade. And then 3D TV comes along. doesn't do that well. 4K TV comes along, doesn't do that well. It's too expensive for the average person. 2014, it's going to be about gesture TVs. So think of the equivalent of Microsoft Kinect or the PlayStation Eye, where you could change channels just with your voice, with navigating. You know, those are reasons to upgrade. With year to year, or even just, you know, month to month, tablet technology is not changing to encourage people to upgrade. You look at Taiwan. Taiwan is pretty well the market where a lot of people have fabs or manufacturing plants, or the manufacturing plants in China are owned by Taiwanese or conjunctionally Chinese interests. So they have a really core indication on what's going on. Because you look at it, I mean, all the screens, everything's assembled in China, everything is made there. They know how much they're going to ship out on a year-to-year basis. Overall, smartphones will increase. Tablets will decrease by about 30%. So there'll be 30% less tablets being made. I think this is a good thing because really it just, there's so much inundations out there. Everybody and their mom between HTC, Nokia, Google, Samsung, Acer, Asus, et cetera, all release tablets. A lot of things get lost in the shuffle. You kind of only hear about their flagship devices, and those receive the commercials, the marketing attention, or the internet headlines. We've tried to follow the tablet industry at Goody Reader, and there's just so much out on a monthly basis that it's impossible to review everything, and it's basically impossible to write about everything, because who wants to hear about some tablet that just got released in India or Malaysia or the Philippines or, you know, countries like that where maybe the local population cares, but not enough of them are reading internet headlines to really make a big difference. So 30% decline. Ebooks, I feel, will also decline in 2014. I've looked at some statistics from the Association of American Publishers that collect monthly data from about 1,200 publishers. They said that ebook sales have been flat or in a state of decline for most of 2013. In August specifically, they made $128 million publishing-wide on ebooks, which is a 3% decline from 2012. I think that this decline or stabilization effect will increase in 2014. It won't be dramatic, but we will see at least a 3-5% decline in books. There's a lot of contributing factors that I feel, aside from just people buying less books. Here they are. Ebook discovery. You walk into a tangible bookstore, things just pop out. You know, there's a psychology, and a lot of big bookstores employ psychologists to arrange things in color scheme, in the way that the eye naturally moves depending on your height, depending on your gender, different color palettes for everything from the walls to the displays. They invest a lot of money in that. I can't say that ebook stores do the exact same thing. Smashwords, for example, they upgraded their site for like the first time since like 2009. It still looks like a Web 1.0 site. A lot of sites don't really look that great. It's not easy to discover that next great read, both from the algorithm point of view, and these bookstores actually employing readers who love to read to hype up the next great book. So you walk into a Barnes & Noble or into an Indigo Chapters in Canada, and you see Heather's Picks, you see people who work at the bookstore, the books that they're recommending to read. You never see that in an ebook store. One of the other things about ebooks is gift cards. Amazon and Barnes & Noble are the two companies that even offer digital gifting. I guess iBooks just introduced it for about a month ago, but who knows how that's going because it's just so new. So you have three companies that allow you to gift an ebook. That is abysmal. You look at Kobo and Sony. They don't even allow you to buy an ebook and send it to somebody over email. They don't have that ability in any of their tablets and any of their e-readers. Why? They have gift cards, but you know, buying a gift card and sending it to somebody and then them getting the code and them having to jump through the hoops to redeem the code, that's terrible. I mean, they don't even have the ability to enter a gift card and have basically virtual credit tied into your account, like a virtual wallet. They don't even have that. And these are companies like that are worth over $100 million or more. I mean, Sony is a global juggernaut. Maybe not the maybe not in the highest profiles they were during their glory years, but you figure if Sony wants to make something happen, they have the resources and the manpower to make it happen, but they still do gift cards and they don't allow digital ebooks. The third aspect is lending out digital ebooks. The reason why I'm personally resistant to ebooks is because I can't easily buy a book and just loan it out to a friend or maybe a girl, a date that stops by or something like that. I can't say, hey, you know, you should really read this book. And then, you know, I lend them the book and, you know, when they're done in a few weeks, I see them again and, you know, maybe they'll give me a book or, you know, it'll encourage a cute girl from going maybe on a second date with me because they want to give me my book back and they feel bad if they hang on to it. So e-reading companies really make it really hard. I mean, Amazon allows select titles to be loaned out for friends. If you buy a book, you can loan it out one time for up to 14 days to someone else that actually has a Kindle email address. Nook has Lend Me, and I don't think that Kobo has anything yet, and I don't really think Apple or anybody like Sony has any type of programs like that. So you basically have Amazon and Barnes & Noble as the only two companies in the world that make it somewhat possible to loan an ebook to a friend. I think that you look at all three of those factors and combine, and from an outsider looking in, you say, what is the point? It's hard to find a book when I do. It's hard for someone to gift me a book, and I can't loan the book out to my friends. That needs to change, and that's why the ebook industry will decline. Speaking of Sony, I do think that they're going to not make e-readers anymore. There was a time from about 2008 to about late 2011, they were doing about 3 e-readers a year. And they were really good. And this was at the time before even Amazon made their first e-reader. Sony was making e-readers first. They really seriously got invested into it, and then they started losing market share. Sony accounted for 28% of all e-readers sold in Canada in 2011. In 2012, its presence diminished to only 18%, and in 2013, they have less than 9% of the market in Canada. Well, what's the reason why? Well, they went from making 3 e-readers a year to a single e-reader, and they didn't really get behind it with firmware updates, introducing new features. For instance, on the first generation Sony e-reader, they had Google Books, and this is a way for you to be able to download millions of free titles from Google and actually to make paid purchases. Sony and Google did not renew their contract, and so for the longest time, these e-readers were being sold. People were saying, hey, you know, free books from Google, I'm down with that. They were to click on it, and it would just say 404 error. And it was like that for at least 6 months before Sony just disabled the functionality altogether in a firmware update. Their e-readers, especially their newer ones, they're solid, you know, in the respect of we've reviewed them all, we've compared them to the competition. The overall reading experience, more than passable, feels like a good device, and it has manual page turn buttons. It also has tremendous PDF support. But it doesn't feel like that Sony has done anything new on e-readers for about 3 years. They've just basically released the same design, so the hardware looks the same. Minor superficial changes, but overall the aesthetics, if you were to put the three generations next to somebody and say, you know, oldest to newest, let's see if you can do it. Nobody would be able to do it. They all look the same, and visually and from the hardware point of view. I do think as well Sony's in the same position as Barnes & Noble is that more people are reading books and magazine and manga and things like that on their tablets or on their Xperia smartphones. They're not doing them on the e-readers. So much like Barnes & Noble, I think that Sony will get out of the e-reader game. The only e-reader that they will release in 2014 is the Sony 13.3-inch e-reader. And this is an e-reader that's geared towards academia and serious business professionals. It's only available in Japan. We've previewed this a number of times from actually seeing it in person to doing a number of YouTube preview videos on exactly what you can expect, showing the device from every angle and so on. This is the device I'm most looking forward to from 2014, mainly because no one's ever done a device that big before. The PDFs seriously look amazing and as intended. The sad thing is that in Japan, so $900 US, it'll be dropping in the first quarter of 2014 from anywhere between $1,100 and $1,200 is what I'm hearing, but it's only available through like Sony's business unit. So this isn't going to be a device that you'll find on the shelves in any retail store. It's only from like business like units, and you might feel like find one or two in the gray market. So like the Rakuten community, eBay, and things like that. That would be the only way a casual consumer could get their hands on it, mainly because Sony isn't bundling their own ebook store on it. So what's the point of commercially releasing a product that Sony isn't making digital sales from the actual hardware? Because really, that's what it's all about, selling the hardware and making up for the lack of hardware sales with the digital ecosystem. Sony really isn't doing too much on the tablet front, but they're releasing more and more smartphones. And that's, you know, mobile reading is what it's all about. More smartphones are going to be produced in 2014 than in any other year before, at the expense of e-reader screens, at the expense of tablet screens. So the future overall looks bleak. I told you it would. You've been listening to the Goody Reader Radio Show, and it's been our prediction episode for the future of ebooks, digital publishing, e-paper, and a whole lot more. So stay tuned for a whole lot more at goodyreader.com.